This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Who do you think is Aotearoa's leading rewilder? My vote goes to botanist Hugh Wilson from Hinawai Reserve. Hugh is best known for showing us that gorse can be an effective nursery plant for native forest to naturally regenerate through. But this episode isn't about gorse. It's about what Hugh and his team are doing with all the other weeds on Hinawai Reserve. Today's episode of Rewilding in Action is supported by the Rod Donald Banks Peninsula Trust, whose vision is to create a thriving and enduring ecosystem of trails and regenerating landscapes on Te Pātaka o Rā Kaihautū Banks Peninsula. Projects supported by the Trust are based on four strategic pillars, namely access, partnerships, knowledge, and biodiversity. For more information about their projects and news, go to roddonaldtrust.co.nz. Kia ora, welcome to Rewilding in Action with me, your host, Maureen Howard. For this episode, I'm on Banks Peninsula again to talk with botanist Dr. Hugh Wilson, the manager of Hinawai Reserve. Of all the people I've met in Aotearoa over the last 31 years, to my mind, Hugh is the person who most embodies the rewilding method through his approach to the natural native forest regeneration at Hinawai Reserve, which has been happening there for close to 40 years. In addition, Hugh has written and illustrated a number of books about New Zealand plants, including some on the vegetation of Banks Peninsula. Hugh and Hinawai Reserve have become quite famous in recent years due to the film Fools and Dreamers, which has been seen all across the world. Despite turning 80, Hugh is still very busy in the reserve. However, Mother Nature's on my side this morning. It's snowing, so Hugh's work is delayed and I get to talk to him for a little longer. I ask Hugh to describe Hinawai Reserve.
And now we look after about 1,650 hectares, but we started off with 109 hectares, so it's basically a regenerating area of native forest in the southeast corner of Banks Peninsula, close to the town of Akaroa, which is crucial in a way to the whole concept of the program. Like, Akaroa has almost adopted Hinawai because of its proximity to the town as a sort of little national park on the doorstep of the town. So that's been a wonderful sort of development. But basically, conservation comes absolutely first. From the very beginning, we opened up to the public on foot. And so we now, the visitation grew slowly, but there's now hundreds and hundreds of people visit. And they don't have to ask permission, and they can explore on foot wherever they like, on the tracks. So that's how, what it is. It's just a big regeneration project on the southeast corner of Banks Peninsula.
But I also think the key thing that has made your project stand out is the fact that it is natives that have primarily come through gorse, isn't it?
Yes, well, the whole philosophy from the very beginning was natural regeneration, and we adopted this sort of name, minimum interference management, or shortened to MIM. And basically that was a complete awareness from the beginning that nature was immensely more capable of putting the forest back, more appropriately, more ecologically interesting. Everything was for natural regeneration. But there's a huge idea that we've got to plant it back. And it sounds perfectly reasonable, but it's actually ridiculous. When you think of 1,650 hectares of land now that we look after, and then think that we could plant it, it's just a ridiculous notion. And I'm a liar because we do plant some. But what we plant is just totally insignificant in compared with what nature is doing. But the trouble is it sounds too good to be true to most people. And I sometimes say, well, it sounds too good to be true, but it is true. And when you think about it, we're too good to be true too. The likelihood of us being human beings on a little planet circling one remote star in this Milky Way galaxy is just mind-bogglingly impossible to believe.
But that we evolved here, yeah.
We evolved here and we're here. So that's impossible to believe, but we believe that. Well, in fact, natural regeneration of native forest on a landscape that's been denuded by human activity is also hard to believe, but it's completely true. And the really good thing about Hinawai, one of the good things, is that all the scepticism, all the cynicism and the disbelief at the beginning is vanished now, because we've been going for nearly 40 years and it's basically changed from a denuded, poorly farmed landscape to native forest in a few decades. That's what nature has done. Our contribution's been minimal.
Hugh tells me about the history of native forest on Banks Peninsula.
With these two big waves of human settlement, Polynesian from about 700 years ago, and then European from much further away, although the Polynesians travelled a fair distance, those two big waves of human settlement basically cleared all of the forest, almost all the forest, because Banks Peninsula was forested from side to side and from top to bottom, with disturbances like slips and very, very rare natural fires, but possibly any one spot burnt once in 1,000 years. That's a charcoal evidence. And now, as soon as humans arrived, the fire frequency just rocketed up. So the Māori settlement cleared about maybe a quarter to a third of Banks Peninsula, of its native forest, of its original old-growth forest. And then the Europeans arrived, and from about the 1860s onwards, they just started burning to get pasture. That's what they wanted. So by 1900, there was less than 1% of the old-growth forest left. There's photographs from back in the early 20th century, and they just show almost treeless landscape. You'd think, gosh, there's no trees left here at all. Even we've got photographs of parts of Hinawai that just show no trees on them at all. But even then, forest was regenerating naturally in gullies and steep places and bluffs and things. So even by 1920, when they were still milling the old growth remnants until the last mills closed in the 1920s, by that time there was at least 10% of forest regenerated again, against all odds, against burning, introduced grazing mammals, poisons and trying to attack weeds and things.
The land wants to be forest.
It's just itching to be forested again. And so the idea of having to plant it when nature's just itching to put it back anyway, all you've got to do to help is to remove the few deleterious things that we've done and are doing. And I'm not saying stand back, because there's a few things we interfere with. We carefully suss out what things we should interfere with and do it, always sort of monitoring to see whether really we are not getting unintended bad consequences from what we think are the good things to do. So that's what it's all about. That's what Hinawai is all about.
Yeah, and I see the commonality with rewilding, as I see it, which is restoring those ecosystem processes, doing the minimum that you have to do. And in the Northern Hemisphere, that might be reintroducing a keystone species then standing back. For here, it might be actually fencing out introduced species.
That's a big difference between Europe and Aotearoa, because The absence of grazing mammals here in the natural ecosystems is a huge difference. And many of those grazing mammals are keystone species in other parts of the world, in the ecosystems of the other parts of the world. So it's interesting, because I've been reading a lot about the Nepean State rewilding in southeast England. And that's fascinating, because the Nep Estate project was so similar in many ways to our whole project, but so different here.
But the principles behind are the same.
Exactly.
In that then you're having a light touch and you're able to step
absolutely
back.
That's exactly.
Yeah. Sure. And so there is this great commonality, I think, with rewilding and minimum interference management. So I'm really interested to deep dive into that. Yeah. Now, the terminology, those words weren't created by you.
No, they weren't. No, Ian McCracken was an ecologist. I did meet him. I haven't seen him for years, though. We used to call him Bracken McCracken. We nicknamed him that. So he invented minimum interference management, and I thought, well, it sounds a bit pompous, but it's exactly right. Because it's not zero interference, and it's not zero management. As I've said many times, in the last 40 years, I've never worked so hard. So nature does leave us lots to do. For example, nature's just completely uncaring about our tracks and our bridges and our information boards and our little huts and things. She just couldn't give a damn about them.
But these things you're doing for humans, not for nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's floods and winds and fires and earthquakes, and nature just throws everything at us. And then we think, oh, no, this is going to take decades to recover. But nature is so resilient in this sort of situation But within a few years, you'd hardly know anything had happened.
So in a nutshell, then, what is minimum interference management?
Minimum interference management is basically telling ourselves, our proud little human egos, that what we do is pretty insignificant and that nature is a million times more competent and more appropriate and even more scientifically interesting, just to not interfere with the rewilding project that nature is so competent at. I'm anthropomorphizing here.
Do you see minimum interference management as allowing a more open-ended approach? When we think of management, we have an outcome, a restoration, and but with minimum interference management, is it acknowledging that actually it's kind of a partnership?
Absolutely, and we don't actually know all the outcomes. You can have a fair idea. And it's interesting because, you see, some of the farmers who were so sceptical to begin with, they would say to me, well, how do you know this is going to happen? And I would say jokingly, well, I don't know anything's going to happen, but I'm about as confident that what are we saying is going to happen in 40 or 50 years, this will all be native forest again. I'm about as confident as saying that the sun will come up tomorrow morning. And they go, ah, they say. But they still remain sceptical. But now they're not, because, you see, they'd have to shut their eyes now. All the farmers around us, I wouldn't say any of them were really hostile, ever, but there was almost hostility to begin with, and difficulties, especially with weeds that are on Hinua, like gorse in particular. That's a terrible weed of pastoral farming. So that was a major, major breaking point in terms of relationships with people who were trying to farm around us. Just as their animals were a major breaking point for us, because they would keep invading through poor fences and things.
So that process has become easier for you, hasn't it? That interpersonal process.
Not only with the farmers, but with bureaucracy as well, because the regional council, bless them, they had this, unfortunately, a very farm-focused idea of weeds. And so we were being forced by law to do things that were actually against what we were trying to do. But not only that, would actually make weed problems worse around us too, because everything that the farmers were trying to do to keep this clear of gorse, for example, favoured the gorse, because it thrives on disturbance. It depends on disturbance. And left alone, which was heresy to the farming community and to the regional council, they just thought we were idiots and naive simpletons. But now, you see, 40 years later, the evidence is just so overwhelming that no one can look at this, even without seeing what it was like before.
And this is the benefit of actually going out and deciding to devote your life to this, because you're able to create an example as much as anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me personally, I don't want to be anywhere else in the world as living on Hinua, watching all this happen and working towards it.
Yeah. So what else appeals to you about this minimum interference management? It must have just kind of rung true for you.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I never thought that there was any other approach, you see.
Maybe you saw some instances of seedlings coming up underneath the gorse.
Wellington was actually a good example, because all around Wellington there was gorse on the hillsides, and still there, but less and less. But the fire regime changed dramatically during my lifetime. Every time they burnt gorse, of course, it sets it back to gorse again. But when the fire frequency goes down, then it just the process back into bush. And that's our capital city. So all around Wellington, people could see this happening. So, yes, it was obvious to me. Yeah. And also here. Yeah. Even on Banks Prince, I could see what was happening. And the bits that had been left alone long enough, all these green natives were just erupting through the gorse. And then they'd spray it and burn it to get pasture back, or even not to get pasture back, just because they thought it was almost their religious duty to fight the gorse. That's what it was like.
And do you also think that as a botanist, you just have that natural curiosity to see what plants nature's going to produce?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And it's incredibly more subtle and interesting than you even dream about at first. Like, I'm enjoying my botanical survey of Banks Peninsula on a deforested landscape, but I was still mapping species that I suddenly realised, gosh, these are all forming intricate, subtle patterns. And that's why planting is a funny thing. You see, you think, well, a plant's native to Banks Peninsula, so we can use it for our planting program. Well, you might plant a plant, you might grow it from local seed and propagate it in a nursery, plant it out, protect it from hares and rabbits and everything. and fenced it off from sheep and goats and cattle, and then nature would not have put that part there. And it might only be almost metres away from where nature would have done it. And certainly there's intricate patterns of some of the species that reach Banks Peninsula and don't go any further south or any further north, and they're almost at the margins of their tolerance. So they're incredibly specific about where nature puts them. And nature's raining the seed down everywhere.
And in combination with other plants so that they may survive and thrive only in that community.
It's because there's competition and communities, all sorts of community involvement as well, plant community involvement, yeah. And birds and insects and lizards and fish, everything.
Well, I saw a beautiful example of it while I was interviewing Bob and Carol for this last episode, and just the clumps of regenerating totara and broadleaf, yep, with, you know, a lancewood poking out of the middle. But there's no way we would plant like that.
No, there's not. And a lot of the browse-resistant, like Bob and Carol's land isn't being grazed anymore, but even on grazed land, things like small-leaved coprosmas, miki-miki, and just all those tough little shrubs, they grow not only despite grazing, but partly because of grazing, because they're removing all the grass competition. Then these clumps of small-leaf tangle branch shrubs establish, and then they allow protection for all sorts of other browse-vulnerable things. That's why there's little islands. Mm. And little microhabitats with rocks and things here. It's intricate and wonderfully interesting.
It is. I thought it was stunning. Yeah. I loved it. So let's go on and talk a little bit about minimum interference management and how it's expressed here on Hinawai Reserve. And maybe we could take some examples and look at where you've decided we're going to do pest control or we're going to do weed controls.
Well, the main thing about minimum interference is that if you're not pretty sure that what you're interfering with is going to have good consequences, you don't do it. The best is not to do it and monitor and scientifically study and just really follow it very carefully. Yeah. So there's all sorts of interesting follow-ups from this because, you see, the weeds alone, the figures are off the top of my head, but maybe 350 native vascular plant species, which makes up Hinawai's native flora. Now, it's not counting mosses and liverworts and lichens, all those, just so about 350 native species, but there's also about 260 introduced naturalised species, which is quite big.
Here on Hinawai Reserve.
Hinawai. Wow, okay.
But of those 260, most of them we don't do anything about. That's one thing. First thing is that nature's dealing with them. And there's even things like things that people would think of as serious weeds. One of the real sort of outstanding examples is Himalayan honeysuckle. It's not a vine, it's a shrub. So it sends up green canes, which are vegetative cane, and then the next year they flower, and then that cane dies right down to the ground. But it's always a shrub because there's always canes at different stages. And it's shade tolerant and it's bird dispersed. And even now people come to Hinawai and they say, oh, there's a Himalayan honeysuckle. You've got to do something about that. Well, in fact, that's an example that's so common, has been so common, that even if we just concentrated on that one species, that would be the whole of our work program. And we'd do nothing. It would not achieve anything.
What is its impact here?
Its impact is that there are places where it's just dense Himalayan honeysuckle scrub. But if we thought, well, we can't do anything about it, we may just have to accept this. So there are some things that you think, if we interfere here, we're going to make it worse. We're actually going to favour these species. They're weeds, partly because they're opportunistic species that thrive on disturbance, and all the native competition is taken away by what we're doing. So in the case of Himalayan honeysuckle, we just thought, well, we'll just watch what happens. And in those years, that was in the first decade of Hinawai, there were places where we were cutting tracks through Himalayan honeysuckle. And there's one place, I wish I could take you over there and see, it's not that far away.
I should note that it's been snowing and we're this is why we're doing our interview indoors.
With the fire going? Is the fire still going? I better put another log on in there. There was a place on Upper South Track where I think we took about 2 days to cut through this dense thicket of Himalayan honeysuckle canes. And then we had the track through and we just didn't do anything else. And now there's one tiny wisp of Himalayan honeysuckle left. It's shade tolerant and bird dispersed, but it's got an Achilles heel because each cane has to get up from the ground and in the second year flowers and fruit, then it dies right back again. Whereas fuchsia, native fuchsia and wineberry and five-finger, they're just putting on this intricate permanent architecture, like a scaffold. So they've got a competitive advantage. And Himalayan honeysuckle is just dwindling away through natural competition to nothing. That's the first example.
I love that. And it's so interesting because I guess you did know about its growing abilities.
I wasn't sure. So it was interesting for me as a scientist, knowing that if we did do anything, we'd make it worse probably. So we just had to watch it. And then it was very satisfying to know that it did dwindle away to almost nothing. It's not a weed issue on Hinawai. Absolutely not. But then there's a handful of plants that, out of that 260 species, there's maybe five species of exotic plants that are serious enough to think, well, we have to try and do something. And those five, we do something, because fortunately they're sparse enough that they're workable. We can actually work on it, and there's a good chance it will be successful to eliminate them.
So that is one of the factors. If you think that you can succeed... Exactly. In a reasonable time period, then that's a good reason to proceed.
Yeah.
But what were the other decisions then with deciding to take action? Did you observe them for a period of time?
Well, we knew a lot about them anyway. Like Old Man's Beard Clematis, an exotic clematis from the Northern Hemisphere, we knew that that was pretty serious. But it's not that common on Hinawai, but there's a huge infestations off to our west. So, and we're always finding the odd plant and tackling a big infestation on the Akaroa side. But it's manageable. It's a lot of work, but we think we can do it. So we're probably going to win now.
So you feel that you're gradually reducing the size of it.
Yeah.
And I guess a priority then is to stop those new little infestations as you see them appearing.
That's the most important, like the outliers. Yeah, and because it's a wind-dispersed seed, it goes a long way. The trouble is, on 1,650 hectares, you can't check every square metre. There's other things in that category, like sycamore, maple. Sycamore's a lovely tree, and it's got nice timber and everything. But it grows very fast. It grows probably faster than any native sycamore, sort of outstandingly fast, and is very competitive. And if left alone, it would form a canopy of pure sycamore, as happens in parts of Canterbury and other parts of New Zealand. But here on Hinawai, we're lucky because it is still, that's another one, it's still manageable. The third category is that it is a very serious competitor of native ecosystems, but it's also so common and so vigorous that anything we do wouldn't achieve what we wanted. Well, fortunately on Hinawai, we're incredibly lucky because I can't think of anything in that category. I can think of things that are close to us that would be in that category. Mm. So we want to, if we ever find one, like one example, perhaps not a very good example, is a passion vine.
Banana passion fruit?
Well, the commonest one on Hinawai is it looks exactly like banana passion fruit, but it's got a round fruit and a different details in the flower. But at a glance, you'd think it was banana passion. But we've got banana passion fruit on Banks Pincher as well. But this yellow, round-fruited one, I just call it yellow passion fruit. That's a close relation, but it's that's a common one here for some reason. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have it here?
We have found one or two plants of it, but that's what we do. We just... Our eyes are open all the time looking for these things. We go off the tracks for animal control and that sort of stuff and exploration. But mostly we can't keep our eyes on every square metre of Hinawai, but we do our best. But the thing is, if we had one of those impossible weeds on Hinawai, as I've said before, you just almost have to say, well, it's not our decision. There's no decision we can make except to leave things alone, because if we tried to do it, we'd make things worse, because that's what many weeds thrive on. Fighting and competition and just trying to eliminate them, which is just creating more disturbance. So then we just have to accept it. And there are things that we do accept, like elderberry is abundant here. Well, not abundant, it's not really abundant, it's common. Dwindling, probably. But it's shade tolerant as well. And we'll never get rid of it. It'll always, as far as I can see, it'll always be part of the new ecosystem. But it's not a significant part. It's just an exotic element which we just have to accept. And that's the point I'm making. There are some plants which will become part of the new ecosystem. And how can we go back to the old ecosystem? It would be lovely to dream about it, but we haven't got moa and eagles and adsbills and things. It's completely changed anyway. So our whole aim is to put immense value onto the local indigenous plants and animals and birds and things, but accept that there will be new elements in it.
I'm very grateful to my guest, Hugh Wilson, for our wonderfully enjoyable chat. In particular, I find it very interesting to know that while over 250 non-native vascular plants are present in Hinawai Reserve's predominantly native forest, just 5 species are regarded as worth removing by Hugh and his team. To summarise Hugh's message in today's episode, the 3 minimum interference decision tools that he uses to decide what weed species to remove are, firstly, if you aren't sure what the outcome will be of trying to remove a weed species, don't do anything. Instead, Hugh says, monitor it carefully. Secondly, if you've got a weed species you're sure is going to be a problem and you're confident you can succeed in removing it without too many negative consequences, then remove it, especially any new infestations while they're still small. And thirdly, if you have a problem weed that is impossible to remove because it's already widespread on your site, then accept it. Fighting it is only going to make the situation worse because most weeds in Aotearoa thrive on disturbance and most of our natives don't. Thanks for listening to Rewilding in Action. I'm Maureen Howard. In my next episode, I continue my chat with Hugh Wilson. Until next time, I will leave you with some birdsong from Hinawai Reserve, deeply loved by my guest, Hugh Wilson, Aotearoa's treasured rewilder who is letting nature take the lead.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.